I'm deeply humbled to stand in front of you, not humiliated. Humiliation is an evil thing. Unfortunately, humility and humiliation sound alike or spelled alike, but they're not even distant cousins when it comes to meaning. Humiliation is an evil thing. No one should ever be allowed to be humiliated or to humiliate another. But humility is a beautiful thing. And humility is openness, it's honesty, it's authenticity, it's integrity, it's caring, it's sharing, it's real. I've been ordained coming up on 33 years. I'm a priest, and I was ordained not as a kid, I was 34. I was in the Navy when I was a young man. And 33 years, that's a long time, you know, and God has given me a gift. I know it. I have a gift with words. My father was Irish. Mother was... and an alcoholic. And my mother was German. And I've traveled the eastern half of the United States on speaking engagements. I've done television work and radio work. And I faced mobs of people at conventions and in parishes. That's how I first met Noel. He was pastor at Immaculate Heart of Mary on Briarcliff Road in the 70s. And he called me in from Washington to do his parish week of renewal, mission, revival, whatever you want to call it. And we had standing room only crowds, and he thought I was pretty good. And so he got me a lot of contacts in Atlanta, and I did the cathedral and a lot of other parishes. But you see how God networked. 20 years later, he's in the program. I'm in the program. He can't make it. And he tells Bill, he's your guy. I stand here humbled because I can't give you a sermon, and I give a hell of a good sermon. And I can't lecture you. And I've lectured in colleges, and I was a high school teacher as a young priest. And I can lecture pretty well. I'm a pretty good teacher. I can't do that with you. I have to share. And when I do, I feel like I'm streaking down Peachtree Road. And that's humbling. The title of my talk is The Spiritual Journey, and the only journey I can talk about with any authority is my own. And that's a hell of a ride. You know, when speakers begin, they often start with jokes or something. And when they do, believe me, it's not to put you at ease. It's to put themselves at ease. So let me begin with a cute little story. Because I bumped into a buddy here yesterday I had never met before, of course, but we're all buddies. And we started talking, and he made it known that he's Jewish. And we start talking. I says, well, you have something in common. My boss is, too, you know. And I asked him to offer some Jewish prayers for me this morning because the Lord has a way of listening to those first. But there was this rabbi who lived on Main Street and across the street, Father Murphy, in a rather run-down little rectory. And the rabbi had a pretty neat-looking home. But there was some rivalry going on. And Father Murphy's roof was kind of leaking, so the people got together and came out and shingled his roof. And the rabbi came out and looked it over, and he, So he called in a roofer and had Spanish tile put on his roof, you know. So Father Murphy, in a few weeks, was out there puttering around in his garden, planting impatiens and calling in pretty little flowers and mowing his lawn. And the rabbi came out and looked, and he said, So he went and called the landscaper, and he got his lawn done, manicured, you know. So one day, Father Murphy drives up in a second-hand Chevy, and he brings out a bucket of holy water, and he's out there sprinkling it and blessing his car. And the rabbi said, holy hell, now what do I do? So he went down to the basement, got a hacksaw, and came out and took 2 inches off the exhaust pipe. If you don't understand, ask your buddy. I get up usually about 5, maybe 5:30 in the morning. I like to get up early. And I have a little radio in the bathroom, and I always turn it on, and I get that 750 all news, all weather. And I'm standing there shaving, you know, getting ready to go down to church to say Mass, and thanking God I don't have to commute when I hear all that horror going on 285. And then on Sundays, on 750, you don't get all news and all weather. You get preachers. And some of them are really good. I mean, I steal some of their material, you know. Some of them are kind of flaky, I'm afraid. But one morning there was this guy, and he was really animated. He was a black man, obviously, and he was very animated. And I love that, you know. I love their style and the way they stir their people. I wish to God we could do it. And he was saying something that hit me right between the eyes. He says, you know, he says, if you're sitting in your living room, forgive me, guys, if don't take offense. If you're sitting in your living room and your TV goes bloop, 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 and all the blips go all over the screen, he says, what do? You go to the telephone, you call Channel 11, tell them to get their act together? He says, no, sir. You sit down and you tune in your TV so you get the picture properly. He says, well, that's the way it is with God. You know, he sends out these messages to us and we're so screwed up. We got ourselves plugged in, but we don't have ourselves tuned in. And we got to work on that. He says, you got to work on tuning into God. And it takes time. And it takes effort. And it takes some skill. It takes time. To waste time with God. You know, the finer things of life, the really deeply, deeply realistic and wonderful and awesome things of life are not perceived with the senses. Oh, we can see beautiful things and hear beautiful sounds and taste beautiful food and smell beautiful aromas like roses, but and we can think wonderful thoughts and create wonderful thoughts. But when it comes to the profound realities of life, the cognitive level, the knowing level, is the heart that is touched. And we, gentlemen, have illiterate hearts. My kid brother is a victim of MS, multiple sclerosis. He was stricken to his 27. He's now 56. He's like a vegetable in a VA hospital. Before he was so dire in his straits, I would go out there. I still go out every year to see him. But he was on canes, and he and his wife, they live in Phoenix. And he and his little kid and I and his wife would get in the car and go up to the Grand Canyon, a four-hour drive north of Phoenix. And the first time I saw the Grand Canyon, I mean, it hurts, it's so beautiful. And it was daylight, you know, and it was just awesome, awesome. And so we went into the Blue Angel Hotel there and sat around the fire at night and talked with all the international people. It was a lot of fun. And everything is get up in the morning, see the sunrise at the canyon. And so you check at the desk, and they have the exact split second when the sun will rise. And it was like 4:58 or something like that. And it was August, and it was chilly, very cold up there in August. So they said, take blankets with you, you know. Now, the canyon is a mile deep. On the top, you have the climate of Canada. On the bottom, you have the climate of Mexico. And there's such a railing and benches, and you have to be careful when you walk around, especially if you have kids, you know, because God. So we went to bed, we set the alarms, put in a desk call, we got up, you know, and struggled through the sleep and helped my poor brother get ready, and we're all excited about just going out there to sit and watch the sunrise. Neat, you know, I'm kind of blasé about it. So we got out there and we sat on the bench, and it's dark, pitch dark, you couldn't see a hand in front of you, you could hardly believe there's a canyon in front of you. And there were French kids over here with guitars singing French melodies, and people were talking and chattering. And all of a sudden, there was a little streak of light in the sky and silence. It was like we were in church. But were we not? Because wherever God is, there is church.
And this little streak of light started flowing liquid-like through the canyon, and color and form and shadow and shapes and depth and magnificence and munificence. And it just kept changing and glowing and coloring, and I was goosebumps, and tears were rolling down my eyes. People fell on their knees, and my kid brother's kind of earthy, and he reached over and knocked me in the ribs and says, "Hey, Ed, what do you think?" And I said, "God, what's he want me to say, swell?" Words are like little toy wagons. They collapse under the burden of meaning. I couldn't speak, for I was being spoken to by God. And it was my heart that was responding. I was in Rome a few years ago on my sabbatical, and these big shots were talking to us in theology and whatnot, and he kept talking heart, 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 heart. And I'm one of these intellectuals, and I'm super educated, and I said, "What's he talking about, heart? What is the heart? What do you mean by the heart?" And he says, "There you are, you're a Westerner with your academics, you want me to explain the heart." He says, "You Americans," he says, "you always want to take the rose apart to find out why it's beautiful." I said, "Yeah, you're right, huh? But what do you mean by heart?" He said, The heart's knowledge begins when the intellect collapses under the burden of meaning. In your language, in our jargon, in AA, that means when we bottom out. The heart begins to understand and know when the intellect collapses under the burden of meaning, and that comes from the top drawer. I thought, holy shit. And I would never let my intellect collapse. Why? Why? Explain it to me. I want to understand it. I want to see it so I can believe it. Gentlemen, that's a contradiction. For when you see it, when you understand it, you know it, you don't believe it. Knowledge is demonstrable proof. You've got aces of spades in your back pocket. It's evidential. You can prove it. That's knowledge. That isn't faith. Faith is a leap off a cliff into an abyss, trusting that arms will catch you. It's scary, and it's very adult. That's faith. And don't tell me you trust in God if you don't believe in Him, and don't tell me you believe in God if you don't trust Him. The profundity of AA is awesome. Let go, let God. That's profound. Because it's a call to faith. God won't function with you on terms of knowledge and understanding. He simply won't. He asks for faith. Trust me. That's what he's saying. Your laughter gives you away. That's called gallows laughter. When we're nervous, we laugh. Because you have as much difficulty in trusting Him as I do. I have so much to say to you, but right now, what occurs to me must be said. I'm a proud man. I'm an egoist. I'm not an egotist. Egotists are obnoxious. They're always bragging and boasting about themselves, and they're so apparent and transparent. Their egotism is raunchy. But egoism is alcoholism. Ego, E-G-O, easing God out. We are egoists. We walk backwards to God with a hand mirror in our hands, constantly primping our psychological and moral, social and economic cosmetics. I hurt. I'm happy. I'm a failure. I'm accepted. I'm rejected. How am I doing? I'm in pain. You know, and we wonder why we keep tripping and falling. the mirror. It's a we program. It takes two to make someone. From conception throughout life, you can never become a fully developed person without a fully developed relationship, horizontally and vertically. And don't tell me you have this love of God and His trust in God and your spirituality as an alcoholic intact if you don't have this intact. This is spiritual. You and I talking together, it's spirituality. And as soon as we start to connect, it's like two terminals on a battery. Connected, the juices start to flow. And that's what God is all about. I loved that movie, Star Wars. I taught English literature, and it's a morality play from the Middle Ages in hi-fi, sci-fi dress. That's all it is. The dark and the light, the right and the wrong, the evil and the good. And when Darth Vader would say, "May the Force be with you," I heard, "Dominus vobiscum." May the Lord be with you. That's what it is. Our problem with God is not a God problem, it's an image problem. Gilbert Keith Chesterton, the great British author, put it this way. He said, in the beginning, God created man in His own image, and ever since then, we've all been trying to repay the compliment. God isn't human. God is not human. He's divine. What does that mean? I don't know. It's way beyond humanity. It's way beyond humanity. We don't have a God problem. You hear that all the time in AA. We have an image problem. Man cannot deal with the intangible. He has to make it tangible. We can't deal with the invisible. We have to make it visible. We can't deal with the abstract. We have to make it concrete. So we put a tin statue in New York Harbor and call it Liberty. And we have birthday cakes and wedding rings and Christmas trees, and we say it with flowers. We have to have symbolism to encompass in meaningful measures the inexpressible. And so we give ourselves images of God. I did. God, was I raised Catholic. We were more Catholic than the Pope. I'm one of six children, five boys and one girl. Four of us went to the seminary. Two of us were ordained. The others quit the seminary before they were ordained. I'm a very happy priest, by the way. My brother, oldest brother, was a priest. He was killed in a car accident. But when I was a kid, we studied the catechism. We studied the Benzinger Bible history, an old-fashioned Bible storybook, you know. And there were pictures of Cain and Abel, and Cain was the bad guy, and he was going to murder his brother, you know. And he was burning his vegetables on his altar of sacrifice, and his smoke was going down on the ground. He was a bad guy. And Abel was the good guy, and his smoke was going up to God. And there was always a picture of God. And I can still see it. And he was an old man with a beard. And he had a crown on his head and a frown on his face and big flowing robes. And he sat on the throne floating on this cloud. And he looked so angry to my child's heart. In fact, he looked just like Grandpa Schuster. And I was scared to death of Grandpa Schuster, my mother's father. He was a dry drunk. He was mean. But he looked like God in Benzinger's Bible. He had this long beard and this frown on his face, and he used to lecture us boys about good behavior, you know. And then sister used to take us over into church, you know, for mass or confessions, and we were little children, the clicker, you know, and would all genuflect and get in the pew and 12 inches apart, and if you turned your head, you got a ruler over the ear. And up there on the wall, above the altar, was a big painting of a triangle with an eye looking out. That was the eye of God, see. And I thought, oh, Lord, he's going to zap me into hell for all the nasty things I've done. And I'll never forget the time, I guess I was about 7 years old, and I was playing doctor with a little girl down the street. out in the backyard. Oh, you've got something I don't have, you know. And my saintly German mother caught us. And that was a sin, and God's going to punish you, and you're going to go to hell if you ever do that again. And from that moment on, I was convinced God loved me from the waist up. I was scared of God. I was terrified of God. I was a child, and there's a great man called Paul who said, when I was a child, I thought and I reasoned and I talked like a child. And then Paul said, now that I'm a man, I've put away the things of a child. When I read that in St. Paul, I say to myself, bully for you, Paul. Maybe it was easy for you, but it's awfully difficult for us. For children's hearts are like soft clay tablets, and they're deeply impressed. Their intellects don't come alive. They're impressionable. And mommies and daddies and nuns and priests and teachers and grandparents and aunts and uncles and preachers and ministers write on that soft clay tablet of that child's heart, and that soft clay turns to rock as you grow older. And it's very hard to get rid of that. How many still see God as an angry old man out in the sky who's just going to get ready to zap them into hell because all the nasty things they've done? And God does not even keep score. And they don't understand that. Language. Language, there's a tyranny in words. Oh, Lord, look down upon me, and I don't want to go down to hell, and I want to go up to heaven. I wonder what they say in Australia. Do you know that the early Hebrews, right after Abraham, they would not even give God a name? They felt to do so was to put parameters on God, to somehow limit him, to make him capable of responding to their coping skills of understanding. And they knew that God was beyond them. They were wise. But then we start giving God a name. And then we even made God human. Jesus, yeah, is human, but God is not human. Way beyond it. You can't connect. You can't tune in without faith. And faith is letting go. And that's what our steps are all about. Let go. There was this little boy, you know, who was playing with his choo-choo train, and it was broken, and he was crying, and God walked into the living room and said, Johnny, why are you crying? And he says, who are you? And he says, I'm God. And he says, oh. And he says, my choo-choo train's broken. And God said, I can fix it. And Johnny said, you can? And God said, yes. And Johnny went back and played with his choo-choo train. And then he looked up and he said, you will? And God said, yes. And Johnny went back and played with his choo-choo train. And God said, Johnny, I can't fix it if you don't let it go. Give it to me. But see, you and I are control people. We're egoists. Don't you feel it when you're not driving the car? And you're in the passenger seat? That's it, man. You got it. We're control people. You ever walk into a group of men and you're troubled and you say, now look, you're over there in Chamblee and you want to get out to Lilburn. You say, how do I get to Lilburn? Every man in the room's got an answer for you. A better answer. How to get there. You know, control. Always. When you're driving along with your wife beside you, you know, and you're lost, and she keeps saying, honey, please stop and ask. I can do it. No way. I'll find it, you know. That's gallows laughter. Faith. When you come to the edge of all the light you know and are about to step into the darkness of the unknown, faith is knowing one of two things will happen. There will be something solid to stand on, or you will be taught how to fly. That's faith. It's very adult. And you don't find it until you go through a kind of death. A death of your own intellect. A death of your own power, your own control. And oh God, did I go through it. You know, I saw it like, you know, a bicycle built for two, and there's two sets of handlebars, and the handlebars in the back can't do a damn thing but give somebody a place to hold on to while they pump. Well, I was always in the front seat pumping and steering that bicycle built for two, and God was like my hired bodyguard on the back seat. And he was pumping. I was so happy he was with me. And we were partners on this bicycle built for two, but I was in the front seat. And I'd get lost, I mean lost, like alcoholics get lost. You know, I don't have to go into details. I got lost, and he'd say, you want me to drive? Want me in the front? No, no, you do enough. I'm doing fine. I'll get back on the highway, I'll be fine. That happened many, many times. Until I hit the brick wall. I mean, I totaled alcoholism. And when I woke up, I was on the bicycle built for two, but I was in the back seat. And he was in the front seat. And I'm pumping, and he's pumping, and he's steering. And I say, where are we going? And he said, pump. And then I said, where are we going? And he said, enjoy the ride. Now, enjoy the ride. Oh, ooh, wow. My life is summed up in this little autobiography. It's five little chapters. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk, and I fall in. I'm lost. I'm hopeless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Number two. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Number three. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Number four. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. And number five. I walked down another street. That's when I found God. I got off that path I was on. And I found God. That sounds strange. A man, I entered the seminary in 1950. And I've studied my ass off. And it took me 11 years of study and training to be ordained. 11 years. And I was ordained when I was 34. And I've taught, and I've preached, and I've worked, and I've slaved, and I'm a workaholic. I broke down with a bleeding ulcer. I vomited blood like congealed jello in New Orleans, right on the pulpit. They carried me off. Bleeding ulcer. 6 years later, I collapsed again. They carried me out in a 9/11 stretcher. The buzzword then was burnout. The guy says, he's crazy. He works like a son of a bitch. He's crazy. But I didn't know what was wrong. I couldn't stop. It was like a merry-go-round carousel careening around and around, and I was getting all these brass rings, and I couldn't get off. And it was the only thing that kept the banshees quiet in the night, that quelled the pain inside of me. And then I started moving from a cocktail now and then to one every day, and then several at night, and then several at supper and lunch, and then before breakfast, and it worked. Oh, God, it worked. Thank God for alcohol. Had it not been for alcohol, I'd have blown my brains out. It worked. Oh, God, it worked. It was wonderful. And it was always there. It was like that woman that always takes care of you and can read your mind and heart and soul, you know. And then I started realizing it took more of the same to create more of the same. And then I realized something's going wrong. It's not working. And I was lost. And nothing. I was about 56 years old then. I'm 66 now. And then some friends, some very, very dear friends. Very, God bless these people. It took great courage. Because my denial was like a steel vault. And I didn't have DUIs. I can't match you guys in jail terms and DUI. I was a class act drunk. I didn't slur words. I didn't miss appointments, you know. But I had no memory left. I blacked out constantly, and it was just a matter of time. I was about to fall flat on my face, and they saw it coming. So they had this intervention, five people. Very loving, very gentle. And one Sunday night, November 8th, 1987, strange I remember that date, they had this intervention, and that evening I ended up in a Holiday hotel down at the airport with another priest sent down from Washington from my boss. I sat up all night in a cold sweat staring at the wall. And we are on the flight to Rochester, Minnesota. The next day we have these treatment centers for clergy. And I went in, I was there 4 months. They had a lot of knots to untie. And then it all turned around. It all started to turn around. And I started to realize it's not alcohol. That's my answer, not my problem. Oh, it became a problem. But it's not my primary problem. I don't know how to connect. I don't know how to live. I don't know how to love. I don't know how to receive love. And I don't know how to give love. You and I are the men and women of this world who have marched into hell for a heavenly cause. Nobody has to tell you and me about hell. We've been there. Hell is the eternal, irrevocable absence of love. Which is simply to say, hell is the eternal, irrevocable absence of God, for God is love. And you and I have been in hell, thank God, temporarily. Because for some unknown reason, known only to his divine heart, he reached down and grabbed you, and he grabbed me and said, "That's enough of that shit, Buster." Now, when a priest disappears from a parish, that's hot gossip. And it was a typical Sunday in the parish, and Sunday night I'm gone. So I flew with Father Leo, who's 12 years in, well, now, God knows, no, he's 18, 19 years in the program now. But he stayed with me the whole week. We flew to St. Paul. We got on a shuttle flight down to Rochester, where the Mayo Clinic is. We entered this guest house. It's called the guest house. There were 35 guys there, men like me. And, of course, all treatment is simply AA. And they came right up to me, and they were saying, you know, because I'm walking in the door shit-faced, you know, and they're looking at me, and they're saying, "It's all right. It's all right. You're going to like it here. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay." And they're very kind, and I didn't care, you know. Where's the coffin? I'll crawl in. Give me a hand. It's over. It's over. I saw myself as a total moral failure. I disgraced myself, my parish, my church. I was a highly visible pastor. It's gone. It's over. It's finished. It's done. I can't go on. I'm tired living. It ain't worth it. It ain't worth it. God, I'm feeling the pain right now. They put me through all these medical tests and these psychological tests, and it's diagnostic, and I was highly toxic. I mean, I was loaded with alcohol. And after about 3 days, Jerry Grosch, this big shot counselor, they were all lay people. They wouldn't let priests touch us.
They were all recovering alcoholics themselves. They were professionals. And Jerry sat there very kindly with me, and he was going through the papers, and he says, will you sign on as a patient? It's 3 months minimum. I didn't know about 90 minutes, 90 days, but that's the only way they can keep intellectuals in a treatment center, keep them a long time. To crack this, you know. He said, will you sign on as a patient? And I was kind of contemptuous, and I said, what? Like, you know, to me it was like, oh, chicken shit. You want me to say I'm an alcoholic? All right, I'm an alcoholic. But down in my side, I knew there was something wrong, something wrong. It was more than booze, and I didn't know. And God, when you mingle pain with the unknown, you've got fear, big fear. Because fear is based on the unknown. And I had no name for this pain, and I've had it ever since I've been a child. And the older I got, the worse it got. And I said, if you want me to say I'm an alcoholic... And he looked at me with such compassion in his eyes. And he says, no, Ed, he says, I don't want you to say you're an alcoholic. Just admit to the pain you have felt since you've been a child. And you think alcohol is your answer. Holy God, he knows, he understands. He knows. It was like, I was like a bell without a clangor, and I had found the clangor. I was a melody without a lyric, and suddenly there was a lyric. He knows, and I fell apart. I cried and cried like a baby. I just fell apart, and he picked me up and held me like a child. And he said, it's going to be all right. You're going to be all right. You're going to recover. I've been there. I said, how do you know? He says, I've been there. I'm an alcoholic. Give me the paper. Give me the damn paper. And then it started. And we'd have lectures, and the doctors would talk to us, and we had one-on-one counseling, and we'd group sessions, you know. And then we had a lot of time. I mean, a lot of time to sit around and just talk and work jigs and crossword puzzles and watch TV and... A lot of time, and I'm one of these little good goers, a human doing, you know. And I said to one of the counselors, why would we waste so much time? He says, that's exactly what you have to do. You have to tell each other stories. You have to listen to each other's stories. You know, you are to be commended. My hat is off to you guys to come here this weekend and waste time like this. Because it's the only way the heart can bloom. It's the only way. The heart speaks best in the sounds of silence. And we need quiet time like this. We need to waste time. There's a wonderful little book called The Little Prince. It's a fable, but it's a wonderful story. And the little prince is nurturing and nourishing a rose bush every day, pruning and preening and fertilizing and watering. And weeks go by, and one day he comes out, and there's a lovely, lovely rose. And he says to the rose, how did you get to be so beautiful? And the rose said, because of all the time you wasted on me. We need to take time to waste on our hearts. That has happened to me this weekend. This is my first weekend here, and I've wasted time with a number of you. And God, what a gift it's been. Yesterday, I took a bit of a nap and worked on these notes, and then I came down and I thought, I'd love to sit by water, and I know there's a lake, and I didn't know where it was, and I got some coffee and walked out the door, and there was a young man. He's here. He won't be embarrassed. And I said, where's this lake they talk about? And he says, I think it's down this way. He says, wait, I'll get some coffee and go with you. I said, all right. And we walked down, and God, what an hour we had together. And last night, another guy wanted to talk, and what an hour we had together. And the dibs and dabs of strangers, of you coming to me and talking and sharing and caring and giving me the opportunity to share and care and waste time and do nothing but touch. And something quite wonderful happens.
The terminals on the battery connect and the juices flow and God gets in the action. Love isn't something, love is someone. And when you abide in love, you abide in God and God abides in you. And when you don't abide in love, welcome to hell. That's what it's all about. I was a kid in high school, public high school, and we had a physics professor. And he wasn't supposed to do it, but he used to drag God into his lectures in physics, for God's sake. He'd drag God in by the hair of the head. And he had such a neat approach to it, you know. And one day he had a pane of window glass, just a pane of glass, and he put some metal shavings, like metal filing dust shavings, on this piece of glass. And it was all just dust, metal dust. He says, "Boys and girls, did you see that?" We said, "Yes, sir." And he had a little electric magnet, and he put it underneath it and plugged it in. He said, "Now watch." And he threw the switch on the electric magnet. And that metal dust went, whoosh! And it was he said, "That's the lines of the magnetic field. That's the positive and negative field. And that's what happens in the earth, the core of the earth. And that's what keeps the galaxies together and the universe together." And he says, "Isn't it wonderful?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "That's what happens when your life gets close to God. It gets ordered, quite beautiful." He says, "Now watch." And he threw the switch off and bumped the glass. It was chaos on the plate of glass. He said, "That's what happens when you get away from God." My God, that lesson never left me. Spirituality is one of these jargonese words, you know, that when you hear spirituality, you think of church spires and church bells and stained glass windows and men in fancy dancy robes like me. And spirituality, it's a jargonese word. You know what it means? Spiritus, the Latin, it just means breathing. When you came out of your mother's womb, you were like a fish living in a tank of water in your mother's womb. You were really in the amniotic fluid in the placenta. You were floating around. Your lungs were not operative. And you came out of that mother's womb, and that doctor had to be damn sure your lungs started to work instantly. So he picked you up by the heels, and he slapped your little butt, and you went, you inspired, and you came alive. And the very last thing you and I are going to do, the very last thing that you and I are going to do is take our last breath. And they'll hold a mirror to our lips to see if it's true. We expire. And in between inspiring and expiring, there's a state of life that all too many people live in, you and I included, for all too long a time, called despiring, desperation. And when you live in desperation, as you and I have for far too long, work yourself to death or gamble yourself to death. Anything that'll take away the pain of desperation. Despirited. Because when you're despirited, you've lost your soul. You and I don't have to save our souls. We have to find them. And that's what happens when you get into inspiration, breathing together, sharing together, caring together. What is breathing but life? It is the beginning of life. It is the end of life as we know it. And so when you get, whenever two or more gathered in his name, and his name is life, he is present. And when you start breathing together, sharing together, caring together, and taking off the layers and the masks, and letting yourself be known, and remember you can't love what you don't know, then desperation ceases, inspiration begins, and the soul has been found. It is not a luxury of life. It's not a peripheral value of life that garnishes life like parsley on a plate of fish. It's absolutely critical. It's absolutely essential. And take spirituality out of the human experience and desperation prevails. And when desperation prevails, we're one step away from expiration, from death. And it's all around us. My God, if you smile today, they think you're on the make. You just try it. Next time you pass through a checkout counter, Winn-Dixie or Kame are, try smiling at somebody and they look at you like you're strange, you know. Recently on 285, you know these young broads, they always have a red car and they're tailgating you, you know. I was doing it as fast as I could go, a big semi in front of me. I was in the middle lane, and I saw her in the back of me. I thought, oh, there she is, you know. And she's coming up and down, and flashing her lights. And what could I do, you know? And she pulled out finally, got beside me, and she looked over, and I looked over, and she gave me the finger. I just had a sports shirt on, and as things would be, I caught up with her and I passed her and I was looking over at her and I went like this. It's on page 83 of the big book. It's on page 83. Spirituality, the spiritual life. Life. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. That's all I'm saying. In perhaps one of the briefest definitions of spirituality, it's all about relationships that we have with ourselves, that we have with others, and that we have with the universe, the higher power. It's very personal, and if it isn't, it's not spiritual. I'm a very personable man. I collect jokes. I actually write them down. I traveled the country like a road show. You have to be good to do that. And I was well-loved and well-respected, you know. I'm very personable, but never personal. Spirituality must be personal, otherwise it isn't spiritual. Your gut has to get into it. Your belly button, lint and all. Spirituality is indescribable, like the Grand Canyon. It's awesome. It's indescribable. And spirituality is healing. It makes us whole. I was about 3 weeks in the treatment center. I was interested. The old intellect was gearing on. I thought, this is good stuff, you know. This is really good stuff. And I'm reading, and I'm thinking, oh, God, yeah, I can relate what Bill Wilson is saying here, the big book. That's Thomas Aquinas, and that's St. Ignatius. And I'm going on and on. I'm saying, this is good stuff. And it was like November in Minnesota, and it was snowing. It was cold as hell. And I was on the second floor, and I had a nice little room and a bathroom. And I'm sitting at the desk, and right out the window there's an eave, you know, with slates on it and a big, deep snow. And some sparrows are falling around in the snow. And I know every detail of this moment. And I'm reading away. And then slowly, gradually, just like the sunrise on the canyon, it started. And, oh, God, I can feel this one, too. I looked up, I'm all alone in my room, and it started. And it just moved all through my body, and I'd never felt this before. And I stood up and I walked around the room, and I said, what the hell's going on, you know? And I went out in the corridor, and I walked up and down, and I was, oh, wow, the glow. I went downstairs, his name was Bob Martin, my counselor, he's an alcoholic, and thank God no one was in there, the door was open, and I knocked at the door and he said, come in, Ed. What is it? And I said, Bob, he said, something's happening, isn't it? And I said, yes. I don't know what it is. He says, describe it to me. He says, what's going on? I said, God, I feel like, you know how you'd use a camera and forget to turn the film and you'd get the print and it would be a double exposure? That was me all my life. I was a double exposure. I lived on one level out here and one level on there. And I said, it feels like it's coming together, and it's coming together. It feels like my heart's sliding into a fur-lined slipper. He says, it's called serenity. Have you ever experienced that? Oh, never. He says, you've been ill at ease a long time, haven't you? I says, holy hell, that's what disease means. He says, yep. You've been in a state of dis-ease, ill at ease, pathologically so, all your life, and you thought alcohol was your answer. And now you're finding it without the drug. Oh, wow. God. Too much. You know, Bishop Sheen, that'll ring some of your bells. He used to be on TV with a prime time in the evening. Milton Berle was also on. We're going back to the 50s now, early 60s. But he was a Catholic bishop who had a tremendous gift. And he had primetime TV, 30 minutes. And he talked spirituality. And he captivated the United States. And he was right up there with Milton Berle in the Nielsen ratings. You know, well, when he retired, many years went by, and Milton Berle was having one of these fancy-dancy specials out of Miami. And they were friendly rivals. So he called Bishop Sheen and asked him if he'd be a guest star. And the bishop said yes. He was an old man. And so he was down there, and he was all dressed up in his regalia in the wings, waiting to go on stage. And this is the true story. And the June Taylor dancers came off the stage, and Milton Berle came up and said, "Bishop, I saw you eyeing up the dancers." And the bishop said, "Well, simply because we're fasting doesn't mean we can't read the menu." "I read menus." But anyway, he said something that's quite good. He said, "Once upon a time there was a little mineral. And this mineral lived in the soil. And he was happy as he could be in his muck. And one day a little root came along. And the root said, 'Mr. Mineral, you let me suck you up and eat you. You'll come inside me and go up above the surface of the soil. And you'll feel the warmth of the sun and the gentle spring breeze. And you'll be able to move, reproduce yourself and feel the gentle dew of the morning and the gentle rain. And it's a wonderful life. It beats living in the muck.'" And the mineral says, "Yeah." And the plant said, "Yes." And the mineral said, "Well." And the plant said, "Trust me." And the mineral said, "Well, okay." And the root went and sucked him up. And the mineral went up into the plant and felt the warmth of the sun, the gentle air, and the sweet rain. And it was glorious. And reproduced himself in seed. And one day a cow came along and said to the plant, "Mr. Plant, you let me eat you. And you're going to come in me and you're going to live on a level of existence that you've never dreamed of. You're going to see and hear and smell and move about and reproduce your kind. And you'll taste food and it's a wonderful way to live." And the plant said, "Yes, for true." And the cow says, "For true, trust me." And the plant says, "Well, okay." And the cow went and ate the plant. And the plant went into the animal level and began to move about and reproduce its kind and see and touch and taste and smell. And what a wonderful life it was. And then one day Mr. Man came along and said, "Mr. Cow, will you let me eat you? Come into me. Assume yourself into me. And you will see and touch and taste and smell and move about and reproduce your kind. But you'll know and you'll invent and you'll create and you'll choose and you'll love. And it's wonderful." And the cow said, "For true." And Mr. Man says, "For true. Trust me." And the cow said, "Okay." And Mr. Man ate the cow. And the animal moved into the human existence level and began to see and touch and taste and smell and move and reproduce its kind and know and invent and all those wonderful things. And then one day, God came along and said, "Mr. Man, if you'll surrender yourself, you will come into me and you will live like you've never dreamed possible. You will live a life that eye has not seen nor ear heard, nor has it ever entered the heart of man, what things I have in store for you. Trust me." And Mr. Man said, "For true." And God said, "For true." And man said, "Well, let go. Let God." Believing is seeing. Seeing is not believing. Believing is seeing. When you let go and you allow faith to become a dynamic in your life, a constant in your life, a vision comes about. And you'll hear God speak. You'll see Him in the smile of a baby. You'll hear Him in the wind in the trees. You'll feel Him in the touch of warm water. Everything about you, you will live and move and have your being within Him. But you have to let go. Faith and trust and love are just simply three sides of one reality. The mind makes the verbal distinctions, but in reality, I love you only insofar as I trust you. I trust you only insofar as I believe in you. I believe in you only insofar as I love you. Damage one, they're all damaged. Lose one, they're all lost. They're three sides of the same gem. No words can possibly sum up what I've been trying to say any better than our own words from the big book. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. A fire broke out one night. The family were sound asleep. Mom and Dad woke up and grabbed the children, got out of the house. And in the chaos of sirens and smoke and flame and police and firemen, little Johnny was overlooked. And he's upstairs window screaming at the top of his lungs, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." And his daddy says, "Oh my God, we forgot Johnny." And he runs across the terrace, tries to get into the flame engulfed home to save his son. The fire's too intense. He runs over the terrace and through the smoke and flames he hears his voice, the tiny voice of his son, "Daddy, Daddy," and he cries out, "Jump, Johnny, jump, I'll save you. Jump, Johnny, jump, I'll save you." And Johnny can hear his father call, but he cannot see him through the smoke and flame. "Jump, Johnny, jump, I'll catch you." Johnny hears his father call. If Johnny jumps, his father will catch him. If Johnny doesn't jump for Christ's sake, jump. He'll catch you.